Today is February the 9th, 2022. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and the other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. That's prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is also available on prn.live on the Internet. We are nearing 2 years now of at-home lockdown, which was begun back in March 19, 2020. Here's hoping we're in the final stages of the lockdown that we're in, and I'm eagerly looking forward to returning into the studio for live calls from you, the listening audience. In the meantime, you can leave us a message with your questions or comments at hank@pcradioshow.org. PayPal admits 4.5 million accounts were illegitimate as fraud problems grows. Customer acquisition is an important business metric used to evaluate the cost of acquiring a new customer. There are different methods for customer acquisition. A still widespread form of customer acquisition is the phone call. The salesperson tries to reach out to the person on the other end of the phone to represent the product or service via the phone. But most of us are aware of the ever-annoying unsolicited and unwanted robocalls. These calls' use of spoof numbers makes it near impossible to identify the annoying callers. Then there is all that mail that you get in the mailbox, bulk mail, and as well as email. The spam mail that daily fills up your mailbox and the e-blast mailing is a widespread form of customer acquisition. With the Internet, we have online marketing within search engines, which kind of works the other way around. The potential customer is already looking for some sort of solution or product, and when searching Google or other search engines, you'll almost get immediately endless volumes of targeted ads that just happens to be what you are viewing on the Internet. Finally, not the least, there is the process of acquiring customers through referrals and recommendations from others, be it simply using them as testimonial for similar companies. With Internet, customer frauds abound. Tech companies are not immune from these attacks. PayPal CEO recently said that the company is moving away from marketing programs that offer incentives. During its earnings call for the fourth quarter of 2021, PayPal chief financial officer said the company identified 4.5 million accounts that it believes were illegitimately created. Over the past 2 years, while e-commerce soared due to the pandemic, PayPal added 120 million new customers. It now has 426 million total accounts. In 2021, the company incentivized customers' acquisition tactics. For example, PayPal ran marketing campaigns that offered to deposit $5 or $10 in a new customer's account if he or she signed up for PayPal or Venmo. It ran into trouble when bots or software created to automatically visit websites and take actions started scooping up those incentives for the sole purpose of seizing the reward. The company is changing its customer acquisition strategy to move away from incentive programs and focus on sustainable growth and driving engagements, or getting current customers to use PayPal's apps more often. He said this change in strategy is separate and apart from the fake account issue. This is the first a company acknowledged that fraudsters can take advantage of these new account programs with such scale. Since the pandemic began, fraud issues have grown at a frightening pace. PayPal fraud challenges date back to earliest days of the companies in the year 2000. It lost $6 million, or $1,900 an hour, to fraud at a time when its revenues was less than $5 million. Its latest fraud challenges and admission that 4.5 million accounts were fake begs the question of how other similar companies are being affected. How much of the growth in some of these companies could be fueled by these bots that are creating accounts just for collecting the incentive? Every financial tech company should look at accounts that sign up with incentive, but they never use the account again. What we're seeing at PayPal is a systemic issue. It is related directly to the identity theft and synthetic fraud that we saw during the pandemic. Bad actors are weaponizing the personal information that they've stolen in data breaches and using bots to launch attacks. The bad actors are going into all kinds of financial tech attacks. The continued acceleration of financial tech fraud is also surprising some experts. It is added that financial techs and banks, they are not getting worse at fraud prevention or loosen their stances. It's the opposite. The criminals are getting smarter and more powerful. Fraudsters are bolder and more talented than ever. GoFundMe gets heat on Canadian trucker freedom protest. GoFundMe has been getting heat for its decision to shut down the Canadian trucker freedom protest in Ottawa. The Freedom Convoy descended on Ottawa last weekend after crossing Canada. The protest was designed to draw attention to the devastating impact of vaccine mandates imposed by the Canadian government on unvaccinated truckers. The protest swelled beyond all expectations, as did the financial support that led to nearly $10 million being donated to support the truckers and their supporters through GoFundMe. Last Friday, the website GoFundMe cited that they are against Canada's Freedom Convoy. They no longer share the goals of those who donated with those who participated in the coast-to-coast protests. The company defended its move based on reports that there have been violence and other unlawful activity. GoFundMe said that after speaking with law enforcement, they were taking down a page raising money for the truckers because the protesters were engaging in violence or harassment, and it is against their policy to allow funds to be raised in support of that. When the company made its decision, there had been only 3 arrests. This action is contrary to when GoFundMe seemed to have no issue helping raise hundreds and thousands of dollars for the Portland General Defense Committee, and compare that with the mayhem and violence in Portland, Oregon in 2020, GoFundMe had no problem at all with that disorder. The site raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for the Portland General Defense Committee Fund to defend rioters who set fire to police stations, vandalized City Hall, wielded weapons, and injured police officers. GoFundMe is a for-profit crowdfunding platform that allows people to raise money for events ranging from life events such as celebrations and graduations to challenging circumstances like accidents and illnesses. From 2010 to the beginning of 2020, over $9 billion had been raised on the platform, with contributions from over 120 million donors. GoFundMe charges 5% commission on donations received. GoFundMe said, given how this situation has evolved, no further funds will be directly distributed to the Freedom Convoy organizers. GoFundMe originally said it would allow individual users to apply for refunds and would work with organizers to send all remaining funds to credible and established charities verified by GoFundMe. But the company soon abandoned this approach. That plan to take and redistribute them to credible charities at their discretion was not widely well received, and one of the loudest critic, if understated, objection came from Elon Musk, who labeled the company as thieves. Early Saturday morning, GoFundMe posted a tweet announcing they will be refunding all donations to the Freedom Convoy 2022 fundraiser. This refund will happen automatically. You do not need to submit a request. Donors can expect to see refunds within 7 to 10 business days. GoFundMe is a social platform. They are free to take sides on social issues. When you start taking sides on social issues, doing so will also limit your target audience. This action for a profit-making organization is not a good business model. Additionally, their public relations press releases, they're not well thought out. When applying for a job, most people have been faced with the question, what is your current salary? If the employer doesn't have a set pay scale for the position, you're faced with a dilemma. Handing over your current salary can significantly reduce your bargaining power, but refusing to provide it makes you seem uncooperative and could cost you the job. For some employees, particularly women, this can lead to pay disparities that follow them from job to job. The Federal Equal Pay Act and similar state laws make it illegal for employers to pay men and women different wages for the same work. Despite these laws being on the books for many years, the pay gap persists. Legislators are beginning to recognize that certain practices perpetuate inequality in pay, even if there isn't necessarily a discriminatory intent. One of these practices is relying heavily on an applicant's previous pay when setting the salary for a new job. Doing so often causes inequality in pay to follow from job to job. Requiring employers to post salary ranges in job ads are aimed at addressing this issue. New York City employers will now be required to post salary ranges in job advertisements as of April 2022. Under a new law passed by the New York City Council, which will go into effect April 2022, employers in New York City will have to include the minimum and maximum starting salary for any advertised job, promotion, or transfer opportunity. The bill available will amend the New York City Human Rights Law to require that employers disclose a salary range, from the lowest to the highest salary the employer in good faith believes at the time of the posting it would pay for the advertised job, promotion, or transfer opportunity on all job advertisements for positions located in New York City. Employers will also have to include the salary range in all announcements or postings regarding promotion or transfer opportunities. As the term salary is not defined, employers should comply with the new law regardless of whether the position is salaried, exempt, or hourly non-exempt position. Failure to include a salary range would be considered a discriminatory practice. The posting requirement will not apply to temporary positions listed by temporary help firms. The bill gives the New York City Commission on Human Rights the power to issue rules and regulations to implement and enforce the law. This is expected to clarify whether the salary range requirement applies to all jobs advertised in New York City or only postings for jobs physically located in New York City. The New York City law is part of a growing trend of wage transparency laws that have been enacted in other jurisdictions in an effort to promote wage equity for groups who have historically received lower compensation. So far, only Colorado's law, like the recent New York City bill, requires employers to include salary ranges in job postings. Intel patent confirms work on multi-chip module graphic processing units. A recent patent published by Intel may be the keystone for its future graphics accelerator designs, and it utilizes the multi-chip module with the abbreviation of MCM approach. Intel describes a series of graphic processors working in tandem to deliver a single frame. Intel's design points towards a hierarchy in workloads. A primary graphic processor coordinates the entire workload, and the company frames the multi-chip module as a whole approach as a required step to guide silicon designers away from issues of manufacturability, scalability, and power delivery problems that arise from increasing die sizes in the eternal search for performance. According to Intel's patent, several graphics instructions travel to graphic processors. Then the first graphic processor essentially runs an initial pass of the entire scene. At this point, the graphic processor is merely creating visibility data. It's deciding what to render, which is a high-speed operation to do so on modern graphics processors. Then a number of tiles generated during this first pass go to the other available graphic processors. According to that initial visibility pass, they would be responsible for accurately rendering the scene corresponding to their tiles, which indicates what is in each tile or shows where there is nothing to render. Intel is looking at integrating tile-based checkerboard rendering, a feature used in today's GPUs. Finally, when all graphic processors have rendered their piece of the puzzle, that is a single frame, they are then stitched together to present the final image on screen. By the way, this is very similar to taking a whole series of pictures when you take a panoramic shot on a camera, and it takes multiple frames and stitches them together. As the rate of semiconductor miniaturization slows and continues to slow, companies have to find ways to scale performance while maintaining good yields. At the same time, they have to innovate on architecture. Semiconductor manufacturing processes are getting more and more complex. It's getting harder and harder to increase transistor density. The only solution is to pair several smaller dies together. It is easier to have two functioning 400 millimeter square dies than it is to have one fully working 800 millimeter one. The yield on the smaller ones are much higher than the larger size dies. The first company to deploy an multi-chip module GPU design should have an advantage over its competitors, with higher yields facilitating higher profits or lower marketing pricing. And with all three companies, that is AMD, Intel, and NVIDIA, contracting the same Taiwan semiconductor manufacturing nodes in the foreseeable future, each slight advantage could have a potentially high market impact. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell. When to move consultant to full-time.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where I come to you with my experience, my knowledge, my history of being in the IT field for, we'll say a couple of years. Maybe it's been a little bit longer. It's longer than a couple of decades. It's 30 years. Anyways, Gerald asked me a question, and there's a reason why I'm focusing on the 30 years, because I have a lot of different things in my past. And Gerald asked me, when is the best time to move from an outsourced hired hand to a full-time in-house technician? I have made that transition. One of my clients for probably, I'm trying to remember, it was 13 years or so that they were a client of mine, and they kept on increasing the amount of work that they needed from me. And this work ranged from setting up the servers, setting up desktops, adjusting things on the network, network wiring, putting up new switches, putting up different Wi-Fi items. And it went through a number of different iterations. And I was progressing along where each time I went out, there was a little bit more work. And we had started to build a portfolio of the different tasks that were set for me. And Mark, that was my client's name, he would adjust and prioritize, and he would then have me out on a more regular basis. We arrived at a point where I was in a transition from I had just left my previous employer. And he said, you know, we need more, while you've got some downtime, we need some more projects out of the way. So he said, why don't you come on over and if you lower your rate a little bit, what we'll do is we will give you more hours. Okay, sure. So I lowered my rate a little bit and he guaranteed me a certain amount of hours. He said, you know, come on out. Anytime you're available, let's kick out this project. This is a bigger project over here. It's a lot of programming for you. Let's have you kick that out. And we went back and forth and back and forth a few times until we got to the point where I said, look, I am actually out here enough right now. If you were to hire me on full time at this amount, you're going to get more stuff done. And we can make this a formal arrangement. He said, deal. Okay. So we had arrived at that point. We had arrived at the point where I was such a value to the company that, yes, it was better to have me on full time. So I've done this. So when is the best time? I'm going to tell you just as kind of an easy number. Once we hit somewhere around, I'm going to say a day worth of work, 8 hours a week for that external outsourced consultant or whatever. Now, I know it seems small. I know that you're looking at that and you're going, well, okay, 8 hours, that's not a whole lot of time. That's not a whole lot there. Yes, but the 8 hours of consulting hours, well, they're already priced up a lot higher than the standard hourly rate of a full-time employee. To give you an idea, it's generally considered to be three times salary or hourly. So if you are paying somebody, basically you're paying them for 8 hours, the dollar value that you're putting out already winds up being, you're paying them 8 hours, you're already up at 24 hours. Or yes, 3 days. So let's go to that next step here. If you're having them out there, you're paying them for a full-time employee at 3 days a week, I will tell you there are immeasurable benefits that come from having a full-time employee on hand. One of the things is they can address the issues that come up right away. For instance, John's computer goes down. Well, that full-time employee can hop on it right away rather than John sitting around and waiting a day or two for the full-time employee to get onto site. Additionally, you start winding up with that, I'll call it that marriage of the tech with the environment, where everybody starts to look to that tech directly instead of them looking to you, Gerald, and then you divvying up the information and translating the information and then calling out the tech and monitoring and managing that tech on a more hands-on basis. I mean, when you're dealing with a tech, you're dealing with a certain level of micromanagement. You're dealing with a certain level of hands-on with that tech. And yes, in the case of Mark, my former employer, consultancy. Yeah, he was having to stay overtime, stay extra hours because I wasn't showing up during business hours. I was showing up after my full-time job. So it actually worked out a really great deal for both him and myself. Yeah, there's a lot more to this, but yeah, my general guidance is once you're spending 8 hours a week on an external tech, just bring them in-house. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. COVID-19 has forced many organizations to allow their staff to work from home, which has blurred the lines with the benefits of being an independent worker. The opportunity to choose how much work you take on, when you do it, and where you do it is the main attraction of freelance or gig work. What exactly is a gig worker? The United States Department of Labor definition of who is a gig worker is one in which the biggest difference between a gig worker and an employee is the way they're classified by the government. An employee, for instance, gets benefits like workers' compensation, health, and retirement plans, and will have their taxes deducted automatically. Their employer will then send them a W-2 tax form, and they won't have to pay self-employment taxes. Gig workers, on the other hand, are under short-term or long-term contracts, but don't receive the benefits, retirement structures, or their taxes automatically withheld. This means they receive a 1099 tax form, while contingent workers can choose to withhold a certain amount of taxes on each paycheck, they rarely do. Thus, gig workers typically have to pay a high percentage in taxes at the end of the year, and their various employers rarely offer to cover the cost of their health insurance. When you have a traditional job, it usually means you're a full-time employee for a company or organization. Each week, you clock in 40 hours or more and receive a steady paycheck. The job usually includes benefits such as health insurance, retirement benefits, and paid time off. As part of your employment, your employer pays your payroll taxes for you. Payroll taxes are the amounts you pay to the Internal Revenue Service based on wages, salaries, and tips. Independent workers or gig workers pay their payroll taxes to the IRS. If individuals miss payments, the bill comes when you pay taxes. A gig worker is a professional who, instead of receiving a regular income, receives wages based on the one-time projects or gigs that they complete. This makes for a flexible work environment where employers can offer payment for only the work that's available for a gig worker to perform. The gig economy is the work and career environment in which these professionals work. But a gig worker can be classified as an employee. There is an evolving classification of who is a gig worker. Gig workers are spread among diverse occupation groups and are not easily identified in surveys of employment and earnings, but they are similar in the way they earn money. These workers often get individual gigs using a website or mobile app that helps to match them with customers. Some gigs may be very brief, such as answering a 5-minute survey. Others are much longer, but still of limited duration, such as an 18-month database management project. When one gig is over, workers who earn a steady income this way must find another, and sometimes that means juggling multiple jobs at once. In July of 2015, the Labor Department issued guidance on worker misclassification. A guidance document is a more informal alternative to a regulation. It doesn't require, as a regulation does, public posting before it's finalized, followed by a period of public comment. It is not, as a regulation is, legally binding. It's just an informal statement of how a given agency intends to apply the law. Businesses find guidance documents extremely valuable in figuring out how to interpret laws that affects them. The gig economy is a tricky area because some gig workers enjoy being classified as independent contractors. It grants them certain freedom they wouldn't have as employees. Other workers don't especially like being classified as independent contractors because it strips them of various legal protections, such as guarantees of a minimum wage and overtime pay, workers' compensation, and unemployment insurance. Employers love assigning work to independent contractors. It's cheaper, especially when you figure in that the employer doesn't have to pay payroll taxes on an independent contractor. People have taken rides on Uber or Lyft or stayed in people's homes courtesy of Airbnb. Journalists are especially sensitive to the issue because much of the profession operates on an independent contractor basis, not always willingly. But the truth is that the percentage of the workforce classified as independent contractor in 2017, the last year for which data available, was fairly small, just slightly under 7%. That's a smaller slice than in 2005, when independent contractors represented 7.4% of the workforce. A recent survey by Pew found that the percentage of Americans who reported ever working via an online gig platform was only 16%. So there's really no such thing as a growing gig economy, at least not at the moment anyway. For better or worse, the overwhelming majority of us still work as employees. The Fair Labor Standards Act defines the word employ as to suffer or permit to work. In plain English, that means an employer either requires a person to work or knowingly allows that person to work. Assorted Supreme Court decisions over the years have added somewhat more precise conditions. Is the work an integral part of the business? Is the relationship non-temporary? How much of the facilities and equipment have been provided by the worker? If the answer is little or none, that person is likelier to be classified by law as an employee. How much control does a business have over the worker? And so on. The government's definition of employment is pretty broad. It is whether the worker is economically dependent on the employer or truly in business for him or herself. If the worker is economically dependent on the employer, then the worker is an employee. If the worker is in business for him or herself, that is to say, economically independent from the employer, then the worker is an independent contractor. California's ABC test, which the state uses to determine whether an employee is misclassified as an independent contractor, under California's controversial 2019 Worker Misclassification Law. Assembly Bill 5, California's ABC test is based on three considerations. To be classified an independent contractor, you must be free from control by your client. You must perform work that's outside the usual business performed by that client, and the contractor must be performing the same sort of work he performs for other clients. In November of 2020, California Proposition 22 exempted app-based drivers from AB 5, effectively gutting it. The measure passed by a wide margin, but this past August, a California state judge declared Proposition 22 unconstitutional and tossed it out. The state attorney general is now appealing that decision. Efforts in states, the U.S. Labor Departments, and other countries to regulate Uber, Lyft, and others could lead to big changes in the business model, launched more than a decade ago. App-based gig work has been around for more than a decade, yet the laws around how companies should treat the people who do that work are still inconsistent or non-existent. 2022 could be a defining year in the treatment of workers who deliver food, give rides, and perform other tasks for companies like Uber Technologies, DoorDash, and Lyft. And after California tried to set a precedent that would require companies to classify gig workers as employees, the companies fought back with Proposition 22 that carved out exceptions for gig companies. The measure was approved by voters in 2020, but eventually was ruled unconstitutional. What is Proposition 22? California's Proposition 22, officially known as the App-Based Drivers and Contractors and Labor Policies Initiative, was approved by California's voters in the November 3rd election in 2020. Proposition 22 defines app-based transportation and delivery drivers as independent contractors and also adopts certain labor and wage policies that apply only to app-based drivers and to companies such as Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash. Last August 20th, Alameda County Superior Court Judge Frank Roche ruled that the two sections of Proposition 22 were unconstitutional and that the measure as a whole was unenforceable. However, it remains in effect while his proponents appeal his ruling. That fight in California continues while several more battles are brewing. Gig companies are trying to pass laws similar to Proposition 22 in other U.S. states, while other countries consider new rules on worker classification. There are also new regulations and court cases that is addressing how much companies are telling workers they can earn and companies' level of transparency on delivery fees and tips. The regulatory and political pressures are rising as workers inside and outside the gig economy are demanding more rights, higher wages, and better working conditions as local, state, and federal governments are increasingly scrutinizing platforms, practices, and policies, and as gig companies are trying to prove to investors they can be profitable. The core question for gig economy is worker classification. Companies treat app-based workers as independent contractors, avoiding standard features of employment like minimum wages, taxes, and other costs. But many argue workers fit the current legal definition of employees. A coalition of gig companies is trying to create a third way for these types of workers, while some governments are looking to shoehorn them into existing standards that would likely make them employees. The National Labor Relations Board invited briefs due February 10th, which is tomorrow, on whether it should reconsider its standard for determining workers' independent contractor status. Also this month, the European Commission proposed new rules that could lead to the reclassification of millions of gig workers in Europe. And India's Supreme Court agreed to hear a petition by gig workers seeking Social Security and other benefits afforded to other workers. But after what happened in California with Proposition 22, it's possible the key fights will be in individual states. Massachusetts could be the next big battleground if an industry-backed measure that would create a different category for gig workers qualifies for the November ballot. Massachusetts has become the next ground zero for gig worker classification in the United States, and a lot of other states are watching to see what happens. Other states that may be gig companies' next stops include Washington, Colorado, Illinois, New Jersey, and New York. Proposition 22, which was approved by California voters in 2020, exempts gig companies from state laws and allows them to keep treating their drivers and delivery workers as independent contractors instead of employees. The Massachusetts measure could be one of the first indication of whether the companies will succeed in their goal of expanding that model elsewhere. Worker advocates say Proposition 22 has fallen short in California. Many gig workers still complain about inadequate wages and not qualifying for the health insurance subsidies they were promised. The gig companies have said thousands of workers have received the subsidies since the law went into effect. Elsewhere, a workforce advisory committee in Ontario, Canada, has recommended a third category for gig workers, like the type gig companies are seeking. Dependent contractors would be entitled to basic employment rights such as a minimum wage, minimum or core benefits, and termination pay. The same committee also proposed a portable benefits plan like the one Uber started lobbying for in Canada earlier this year. What are the pros and cons in the gig economy? The gig economy is a relatively small but ever-growing way of earning money. In the United States, with more and more companies employing this model as their primary functioning mode, the gig economy is becoming a livelihood for more and more people around the world. The gig economy refers to workers who rely on freelance contracts and one-off jobs as opposed to a fixed salary position with one company. Many musicians and artists use this mode of working alongside other workers, such as mechanics, contractors, taxi drivers, and others. Entering the gig economy has never been easier, either as a company or an individual just looking for work. The pros and cons of the gig economy for companies and workers are such that, like for companies, there are both positive and negative points for using the gig economy as a company owner. The pros: no fixed salary. Having employees on a fixed salary means that you are required to pay holidays, sick pay, and notice period salaries. This is inevitably expensive for the business. Using zero-hour contracts avoids this. Lots of flexible employees. Having a vast number of flexible employees means you are less likely to rely on a few people. This means that no matter what the job is or where it is located, you're likely to have it covered by one of your many workers. But there are negatives for companies to have workers. Workers are not as invested because they are casual workers. Employees are not loyal to your company and can leave at any time. In addition, gig work can reduce the worker's incentive to do a great job because if anything comes up, they can easily switch to another company. And then there are ethical issues. Ethically, the gig economy has come into question many times. If you are a company that thrives on ethical reputation, be careful with the gig economy. Due to the fact that employment is casual and no benefits are given to employees, you can run into ethical dilemmas when it comes to the treatment of workers. Well, what are the pros and cons of the gig economy for workers? The pros are flexible work. For those with complex and fluctuating needs, such as students, those with young families, and those with health problems, this can be a great way to work without the pressure of a strict routine. You can decide when you work and how much. This creates freedom to take care of dependents in your life and also take care of your own health and well-being. There is low commitment. If you find yourself disagreeing with the work you are doing or you've had a bad relationship with your chosen company, it is very easy to just pick up and leave and take your employment elsewhere. Remote working. If you're not interested in office life, the gig economy just might be for you. Working as a delivery driver, a contractor, or similar, you can have the freedom to travel around during your day and never get bored at sitting at a desk. And then there is the simple and SEP IRAs. They are for self-employed individuals or small business owners. To set up a simple IRA, an employer must have 100 or fewer employees earning more than $5,000 each, and the employer cannot have any other retirement plan besides the simple IRA. So if you happen to be a gig worker or any business owner that fulfills the requirements, you can have, as an individual with freelance income, you can open up a SEP IRA. The advantages of a SEP IRA plan: limits for a self-employed individual. Contributions are limited to 25% of your net earnings from self-employment, not including contributions for yourself, up to $57,000. Whereas there are limits to employee Roth and traditional plans that are capped at $6,000. Well, there are some negatives to being a gig worker. High stress. With no fixed income, the gig economy can be stressful. If it's difficult to find work, you might constantly be searching for work where there is none. This can lead to a decrease in your monthly income and impact you and your family. There's no safety net. Without things like healthcare benefits and fixed contracts, it can be difficult to feel safe in the gig economy. If something goes wrong or a company cuts down their numbers, you can be left jobless at the drop of a hat. Taxes. Seeing as employers do not pay your income tax on your behalf, you pay your own. I've been a gig worker for a number of occasions, and I could tell you that my earnings was greater than being an employee, even when I compare it to all the benefits I had as an employee. But you have to have the intestinal fortitude to be able to have slow periods or periods where you are just looking for work. Some people thrive well from the system, while others find it, well, a huge challenge. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston, medical items that were at CES 2022.
Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty, you were telling me last week something about medical at CES North Hall. And I said, I hinted that it would be in regards to COVID, and you said, no, we'll go in a different direction. So let's go.
Indeed, yes. One of the things that I saw from two different companies and hints of in three others,
mm-hmm, yeah,
is the use of small radar in tracking people, pulse rates, heartbeats, and overall health versus distress.
Okay. All right.
Some of them were geared at sleep. Mm-hmm, if you have mm-hmm. trouble sleeping, they could potentially adjust your mattress for you or hit you on the head with a hammer or something. But
bunk. You'll sleep better now.
Find us, yes. Warner Brothers Medical Science.
Oh, wise guy. Yes, go on.
And I was impressed by that. Less with lasers than you might expect.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
There was somebody who had one of those, wear this cap or put this on your skin and these lights will make you better. I didn't go there because I don't care. If I want light to make me better, I'll move out of Cleveland and then get to where there is some light.
Yeah, I've had a few different companies over the years. They keep telling me they want me to try out their laser light thing to restore hair. I'm like, I shave my head on a daily basis. Why would I even go in that direction?
Well, there's your chin.
There is much. I don't shave that daily. Okay.
All radio people, take a good look. You can see it's gray and white.
Yes, it is. All right.
There was a highly regarded medical company there that showed a number of wearables that could help track your health and report it back to your doctor.
Okay.
And these were non-invasive. You know, they could measure surprising numbers of things. And let me, without being very specific about them, let me give examples. If you have issues with insulin, if you have issues with carbon dioxide in your blood, if you have issues not only with sugar levels, but with pulse rate or irregular pulse or irregular heartbeat. If you have issues with volatile organic compounds coming out of your skin because, right? These are all things that this new technology is either doing or can adapt to do.
Okay. And I think we've been seeing that coming along. I remember there's a product that you got a review unit for me, the Yoohoo. I have that monitoring my office on a regular basis. But, you know, it's a soda can size. But all of that different kind of stuff is getting smaller and smaller all the time. So, yeah.
I spoke to two vendors of solid-state sensors, Bosch and Sensirion. And both of those have sensors that are going to make that much more interesting. And in the case of Bosch, the sensor builds in an interface to deal with AI on something as small as an ARM4 processor, kind of typical of what you might find in a smartphone, for example.
Yeah, definitely.
So that stuff is looking very promising. Why didn't it happen in the 50s so we could already have it now?
I'm looking forward to the flying car. Oh, wait. No, that's still many, many decades off.
Oh, didn't I tell you I had a flying car? Well, not exactly that. I got rear-ended.
Oh, dear. Oh, no.
I was waiting to turn left, and a kid in a Jeep behind me was doing 45, and the only thing that stopped him was my Subaru.
Subaru, yeah.
Yeah, and Subaru's very safe car. The rear quarter panel that overlapped the back doors, and Geico totaled it out for me, so I've ordered a new one that I get at the end of January. That'll be fine at Forester this time for a little more leg room.
Okay, all right, very nice.
And that's getting better. So I've been, renting other cars in the meantime, and the only thing I really like is you never have to take the key fob out anymore. You just hold things or push buttons.
Yeah, definitely.
And some of that was at the show, but not in digital health. Digital health had this, well, I can't talk about that, but I will say you got a piece of hardware for free, but then you had to subscribe to the software to make it useful.
Unfortunately, I think we're moving in that direction in far more places than we should. I mean, you know, what is it? Is it the Peloton?
They have their own problems, you know.
Yeah, you've got your bicycle, but now, okay, you've got a $50, $80 a month subscription fee for your, you know, just buy a regular bicycle inside, you know, one of those old-fashioned, just mechanical.
Or get fat and die. I mean, that's cheaper.
Oh, dear. You know, I've got a head start on that one. So,
No, you don't. And there was a robot that blew, in the show, it just blew steam. But in real life, it can use a steam jet to eject various kinds of germicidal sprays.
Okay.
So you can use it in an operating room or a food prep facility, for example, as long as the spray itself doesn't do harm. But I don't have to figure that one out.
So it sounds like CES really had a lot of the medical stuff going. It was really
it was a focal point.
Okay. All right.
Even more so than Eureka Park, you know, Make-A-Wish Foundation. Mom said I could do this for real.
Yeah. Understood.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Marty. The upcoming 46th Annual Original Personal Computer Festival, otherwise known as TCF, the original and oldest computer festival in the world, is March the 19th, 2022. It is a virtual festival via Zoom, and the website is tcf-nj.org. The time for the festival is from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, and the keynote speaker is Bob Kopp, Disrupting Environmental Climate Changing Using Technology, and he is the co-author of the UN World Climate Change Report. He is from the Rutgers Institute for Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences. At the festival, there will be other interesting topics of presentation, such as secure communications with quantum computing, computers changing photography, Bitcoin trading using neural networks, ham, cram, and testing, and a full day of presentations on IT professional topics. Saturday, March the 19th, 2022. The time is from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, and the website is tcf-nj.org. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. By the way, if you're interested in attending any of the club meetings that have remote access, log on to their club website for remote meeting ID. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a presentation of Lightning Talks, Buy and Sell Stocks on Your Smartphone Commission-Free, Portable Applications and Portable Operating Systems. Thursday, February 10th. Meeting time, 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is nyacc.org. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, February the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is limac.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation on topics on privacy. Thursday, February the 24th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is pcug.com. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on disruptions at scale through innovation. Thursday, March the 3rd, meeting time 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, March the 4th, meeting time is 8 p.m., online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is also available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.